The Lansing Board of Water and Light's internal review was made public last night. According to the Lansing State Journal, Steve Reed and Matthew Miller, the reports say the utility had the optimal number of line crews on site at the right time to respond to outages, and customers who suggest otherwise are wrong. This is straight from the story. If more crews had been available in the early stages of the outage that left an estimated 40,000 customers without power, those crews would have been idle or at safety risk until damages were assessed and more BWL employees were freed up to accompany outside crews and contractors. The story then points out that despite this assertion, the BWL is hiring 3 line workers and has signed 5 new mutual aid agreements, including one that would bring in crews from almost any state, according to the report. In the meantime, we are less than 6 weeks away from the review by Mike McDaniel's outside review team. Again, what we got last night was the BWL's internal review. Current state will continue to follow the story. We're glad you're along here for Wednesday. During his State of the State address last month, Governor Rick Snyder pledged to create what he's calling the Michigan Office for New Americans. He did so on January 31st and named our next guest to run the office. Bing Goey is from Grand Rapids, Michigan. The idea is to attract and retain highly skilled immigrants here in the state. Bing Goey emigrated to the United States from Indonesia via the Netherlands in 1960. His Eastern Floral Company has 6 locations, and Bing Goey joins us on Current State to talk about the early days and the future of Michigan's Office for New Americans. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Nice to meet you. We've briefly discussed the idea behind the Office for New Americans, but tell us more. Why do you think Governor Snyder formed this office?
You know, what is interesting about Governor Snyder, and I met him on the campaign trail in 2010 when he was running for the office of governor. You know, he is a very innovative and visionary type of leader. He doesn't sit on his laurels. He in the last 3 years, what he created, 220-some thousand private sector jobs and all those things. But he realizes that as the state of Michigan, as it must continue to grow, it must find different sources for its growth. And so he looked at the talent, the international talent that is already here in terms of our international students and other immigrants, and recognizes that as we shift from a manufacture-based economy to a knowledge-based economy, that we need different kinds of talent. And those talents come from STEM field, educated young men and women. And so he looked at this and said, why would we not want to retain these young talents that we already have in the state of Michigan? We know based on our studies that by year 2018, Michigan will need to fill 274,000 STEM field related jobs by 2018. And so we don't have that many U.S. born citizens and students here in those fields. And so he looked at that and said, but we have international students here studying in those STEM field related positions. And so he was very interested in making sure that we would do everything we can to be able to fill those 274,000 jobs with the talent that we needed.
You're an immigrant yourself, of course.
I am.
You run a floral business.
Mm-hmm.
Besides those obvious qualifications here, tell us more about why you think you got this job.
Well, I think the reason I got this job is because I was working in Grand Rapids in West Michigan in this area already. We knew in West Michigan that we needed to create a more diverse and inclusive economy, bringing in the talents of everyone, no matter where they came from, no matter what they looked like. We were looking at talent as the only criteria. And so I think he heard about my efforts there, and I think he felt that was something that he wanted to have done at a state level. And I'm assuming that he vetted that out and felt that I was the right person to lead his efforts in making sure that the state of Michigan continues to grow in its economy, and that this economy is shifting and is changing and is requiring different types of talent than we needed maybe 30, 40 years ago.
We'll also note that you've run as a Republican for the State House in Grand Rapids a couple of times, unsuccessfully, as it turns out. But tell us more about the mission of the Office for New Americans. It is to analyze proposals and policies related to immigrants and to make recommendations about them to the governor. What policies or proposals are on your radar at this point?
Sure. The governor has already stated that he's requested the federal government to give the state of Michigan these additional 50,000 EB-2 visas. EB-2 visas are the visas that are for people with advanced degrees and an exceptional business skills. And so, you know, he wants to use that to help reinvent the city of Detroit, because we need Detroit to be economically strong. He also wants to use that as an incentive to bring new population back to Detroit, because, you know, Detroit has lost significant population. And he's also wanting to use the EB-5 designation, which is the EB-5 regional center designation, as a way to improve, in foreign investments, using their dollars to invest in new businesses here in the state of Michigan. If granted the regional center designation, Michigan will only be the second state in the nation to have received that designation. Vermont would be the first one.
We're talking with Bing Goey, the new director of Michigan's new Office for New Americans. Governor Snyder calls himself the nation's most pro-immigration governor. I have to ask what you know about his position on federal immigration reform.
Sure. I think what he's talking about is legal immigration. He believes that the programs that we already have will allow us to, if used properly, will allow us to grow our economy in the state of Michigan, will allow us to fill the holes that we need in our jobs that are being unfilled because of the lack of talent. And, he's working hard to make sure that the federal policies does not inhibit us and prevent us from doing those things in the state of Michigan.
His emphasis last month was on, as we've been discussing, immigrants with skills. Do you know where the government or the governor or the administration stands on, say, a path to citizenship?
No, I really don't know. And I think that is one of the things he's just asked the federal government to do, is to make a decision on that matter. He does not have a position on that. He's more concerned about the fact that we do need, in the state of Michigan, we do need more of these high-talented, advanced-degree individuals to help us continue to grow our economy. And, we as a state, he has no say in the matter of, the pathway to citizenship or all those other issues, because they are federal issues. Mm-hmm. All he's asking the federal government to do is make a decision so that we don't get distracted by this conversation.
Well, given the creation of this office, do you think the governor could take a position on a pathway to citizenship if he were to win a second term, for example?
Well, you know what? You have to ask him that question. I don't know. I don't know. No,
he's officially know. Agnostic on or impartial on the decision.
At least that's what I'm hearing. And his instructions to me was being, you have to figure out a way so that we can retain the talent. You know what's happening in a global economy like this is that, where before maybe our talent pool was regional or statewide, our talent pool now really is the world. The world's really shrinking, right? And the talent is coming from all over the world. And we as a state must make sure that we are doing everything we can to bring that type of talent to supplement and add to the talent we already have in the state of Michigan. We just don't have enough. And so we want to use that as another pool, talent pool, to be able to fill those jobs that we need in order to continue to grow our economy in the state of Michigan.
What do you say to English first proponents? Should a mastery of English be required of immigrants?
Well, I don't know if that should be a requirement. All I'm saying is that, most of these individuals that we're recruiting are people who already are very proficient in English, and they are, they're highly skilled, and they're also studying for an advanced degree. So at least in this particular area of work that I'm involved with, I don't think that speaking English is an issue for these particular students.
What are the current obstacles facing immigrants in Michigan?
In regards to,
just the larger picture, legal immigrations.
Well, you know, I think the challenge is for many of these students, and I've been talking with many of these students already, these international students, the challenge is to find jobs and to find reduce the very difficult process that employers have to go through, that they have to go through in order to be employed, you know, here in the state of Michigan because of federal policies. And I think what we're asking is, can you at least, you know, look at your immigration policies, and can you at least make it more reasonable without giving up the security issues and all those things that's important to us as a nation? But can you at least make it somewhat more manageable so that we can retain the talent that we need in the state of Michigan to continue to grow our economy?
Do you feel your office is adequately funded?
You know, at this point, we are really working hard to make sure that we can work with what we have. We certainly, you know, sometimes money is not always the answer, but certainly money is an important part of that as well. And you know, and I look at this as an investment. You know, I've been in business all my life, and I know that there were times in which my staff would say, "Well, why are you doing that now?" And he said, "Well, because if we don't do this now, we will pay a lot of bigger expense and a lot bigger cost further down the road." So this is really an investment in the future, and I think that's what Governor Snyder is looking at. And we will certainly be very – listen, I'm a business person. I don't want to waste money. I've never wanted to waste money in my business either. So we will make very good use of the whatever funds that we have to make sure that we accomplished the ultimate goal, which is better-paying jobs for the citizens of Michigan – a growing economy that is sustainable and that is also competitive with the world, and we will you know make sure that you know we will have the talent needed in order to you know to continue that growth.
How are those dollars best spent, do you think? Are you that far into the process that you've started to assess that?
Well, you know, this is my third week, so. We've been doing a lot of thinking, and the governor has had other people, you know, involved in this matter for some time already. So, the best way to use it is to educate the employers, because businesses also may not realize the programs that's available out there to help them grow. You know, the thing about this whole policy of the new Office for New Americans and the governor's vision for the utilization of immigrants and immigration as an economic tool is that it is not only about immigrants. You know, the strategic plan or the strategy of immigration is not a zero-sum game. It's not immigrants win and non-immigrants lose or vice versa. It's, you know, his vision is to create, to use this tool as a way for everyone to win. So I think, you know, how we will use it is to educate the employers, to educate the students to the possibilities that are available in the state of Michigan, and to educate the citizens of the state of Michigan to understand how valuable this will be for the future of the state of Michigan, for their children, for their grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
Do you see any inconsistency in the governor's desire to create a welcoming atmosphere for immigrants while at the same time taking a position on issues like gay marriage or granting benefits to the gay partners of state employees that his critics, at least, would say are reasons for gays not to stay in Michigan?
You know, I think the governor certainly has you know his reasons for taking that position, and I don't know what they are, and that's his decision. My responsibility as the director of this new particular office is to look at how do we create this welcoming culture for immigrants, and those are things that we have to do, and certainly that may play into some other areas that is being discussed, some other social issues, but I can't speak for the governor, and he's made the decisions, and I'm sure those decisions are based on. And solid reasons for making those decisions.
We want to thank our guest. Bing Goey is the new director of Michigan's Office for New Americans, and he's been on the job just a few weeks. We've been chatting with him. Thank you, Bing.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
reminder that if you like the music that you hear on Current State, we are tweeting the song titles and the artists every day. Just follow us on Twitter, at KAR, Current State. It's all there. It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today, we feature Soup Grant Lansing, which hosts dinner events to raise micro-grants for community organizations. Joel Meredith and Heather Borden help run Soup Grant Lansing. The pair stopped by to tell us more about their organization. Heather, the founder of the event, explains where the idea for Soup Grant Lansing came from.
I was watching PBS. I saw a special on Soup Detroit. I think they call it Sunday Soup there. And they basically outlined the idea and showed how much impact they were making in their community. I thought it was a great idea. So I'm a longtime Lansing resident, and I wanted to bring the idea home.
And Joel, help us understand how the events work.
Well, at the events, people come in, pay $5 at the door, and the $5 will get you a vote. As people gather, they can help themselves to soup and bread. They can meet new people, bring friends along. And after people have had the chance to eat, we have a range of presenters, usually two or three, who will get up and explain a project that they're working on here in the Lansing community. After the presentations are through, we have voting. People vote on the project that they like the best, and the $5 that they give at the door will go towards a micro grant that we give away that night that will go and support their project.
So an immediate effect. People make their pitches, and then they find out that night whether they could get the money or not.
Absolutely.
This is a unique approach. I don't think I've ever heard of anything quite like this.
Yeah, it is a pretty unique approach. I like it because it's unbureaucratic. Anyone can apply. It doesn't have to be a nonprofit even. So if you have a good idea, you feel like it'll make a positive impact in your community, you can write a short little grant and present it and potentially walk home with some cash for it.
Heather, when did you launch Soup Grant Lansing?
I think it was this last August, 2013, was our first one, I believe. And we've made some changes since the first one, but overall the concept has remained just the same. We've moved to a new location, but...
Have you outgrown your last one? Have you seen growth since you started?
We've seen a bit of growth, particularly when Joel joined the team in October. Then we started seeing some exponential growth in attendance because he's kind of been our brains online. He's doing all of our social media.
Ah, okay.
So,
why did you decide to join, Joel?
Well, like Heather, I'd heard of Detroit Soup as well and was really intrigued by the idea. And I was out for dinner one night with my partner at Fork in the Road and saw a poster for Soup Grant Lansing and thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder if they've got something like Detroit Soup here in Lansing. So we went. I met Heather. I met her mom, who makes all of our soups at Soup Grant. And I volunteered myself that night.
What are some of the organizations or projects that have been pitched at your event so far?
We've had a lot of really good ideas. We had a prescription... A plan to get non-prescription vitamins and supplements to elderly community members who didn't have insurance coverage for them and couldn't afford them on their own. They got funded. We've had local gardens who needed funds to continue having utilities in their gardens that feed community members. Joel had a backpack program idea that didn't get funded, but is still being supported by the community of Soup Grants. So it's kind of sometimes even the ideas that don't get funded end up somehow being supported.
Hmm. Have you followed up to see the impact some of the grants have had on the recipients?
Yeah, we're always in the process of following up. Joel is pretty much the one handling that. We had a Little Free Libraries grant that came through that got funded, and they've got big plans for the spring. They found another community organization that wanted to do the same idea, and they've partnered up to kind of double the impact of the money. So, and lots of other ideas are in the works right now, like that prescription program.
Any other funding besides the $5 that the participants come to the door with?
Right now we're working on a campaign on Indiegogo to support some of the work that we're doing. Indiegogo is a crowdsourced funding website that you can use to bring donations to your project through the website Indiegogo. And right now what we're using that for is we have a very gracious host in Grace Lutheran ELCA over on Martin Luther King Boulevard, and we wanted to be able to give back in some way to them. So we have this campaign running through March 9th that is raising some extra funds, because all the money that we raise at the event goes towards the microgrants.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to that, we'd like to have a little bit of extra cash so we can support our host. We have a logo makeover contest going on right now, because when I came on board in October, I made the logo myself on Microsoft Paint. I'm not much of a designer. So
already in need of a makeover.
Yes, already. Yes, absolutely. And we want to support local designers and local talent, and not just be giving money to charities, not just be giving money to neighborhood organizations, but also be supporting the local talent here and the artists here in the Lansing community as well.
So beyond providing the micro grants, Joel, it sounds like the events also foster relationships within the community.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
You have a dinner coming up tomorrow night. What are some of the projects that will be pitched tomorrow?
On Thursday, it's every third Thursday, you're right. Tomorrow night we are going to be hosting three project ideas. This will be our first time having three ideas. One is Grammy's Goodies from the Bath Farmers Market. And then we also have, Joel, help me out, I can't remember.
We also have a new food interest group called Midmitten. It's Midmitten
Homemade.
Midmitten Homemade, which is promoting the local food scene and promoting bringing different ethnic perspectives, different cultural perspectives into locally sourced food, and educating people on how to better take care of themselves and prepare their own food. So that's the second one. And then the third one we have is actually Advent House Ministries here in Lansing. And they're presenting on their weekend programs, which go to help children in the area get three meals a day, have some sort of weekend programming so that they have support when they're not in school.
And do you want to tell them about the backpack? We have a concurrent backpack project happening tomorrow night. We're accepting donations tomorrow night for the backpacks for the homeless project that Joel started.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
He doesn't have to, because you just did.
Okay.
So well done. You're spending your own time and money on this project. Why is it important for you to host these events?
For me, it's I guess it's kind of a ministry for me. I love food. I really love soup. It's my favorite food. And I like connecting to the community. I really believe that there's more power in the people coming together. So it was just kind of a way to make a venue for that. Joel, what do you think?
I'd echo all those ideas. I'm new to the area. I'm originally from Grand Rapids. I just moved here in August. So for me, it's also a social aspect, that it's a way for me to meet new people, find people who have common interests, and just bring people with great ideas together. That's been a lot of fun.
We were talking briefly about the Detroit variation on this project, and that is huge. Would you like to get that big here in Lansing?
I think so.
It's hundreds of people who show up at these events, right?
Well, the great thing about the Detroit Project is, and they're one of the biggest in the nation, I believe, their grants are thousands of dollars, which can have a great impact. Larger projects and ideas can be funded. And although I really like the small projects and the impact that we're making with just a little bit of money, I think it'd be great to make an even bigger impact in some ways.
Heather Borden and Joel Meredith are part of Soup Grant Lansing. Their next event starts at 6:30 tomorrow night at Grace Lutheran Church. Great to meet you, and best of luck to both of you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much.
We know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work, but we can't possibly know about all of them, which is why we need your help. If you know of a person or organization who is doing great work in the community, let Neighbors in Action know. Send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. How does it feel to be on your own. No, how does it feel to be a Waverly Warriors fan today, the day after your team upsets the top-ranked team in the state at their gym? I can imagine. It happened last night. Waverly 54, Jackson Lumen Christie, number one in Class B, boys 49. That must feel good. Congratulations, Warriors. It's current state on WKAR. Last week, workers at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, voted down a proposal to join the United Auto Workers Union. The UAW had expected to win that vote, and the rejection is seen as a blow to efforts to expand membership by unionizing plants in the South. What does the loss mean to the future of the UAW? Well, late yesterday, I spoke with Mickey Maynard, editor of Curbing Cars. Mickey's covered the auto industry for media outlets, including the New York Times, and she's currently a visiting professor at Arizona State University. I first asked why the vote went against unionization.
Couple of reasons specifically why this vote failed. First of all, it was always going to be close. Even though the UAW says that 75% of workers signed cards in favor of an election, you never know until you have the election whether that's solid support. Chattanooga, Tennessee is not really the Deep South. It's getting to be the Deep South, but it's always been kind of a progressive community. It's actually the community where the New York Times was born. So it's a community that escaped a lot of the perils of the civil rights movement. I wouldn't say it's a labor-friendly community, but I don't sense that it's been an anti-labor community over the years. However, there are people in the local business world who don't want to see unions come in, especially the UAW. And one of the big opponents of the UAW was Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And Bob Corker's participation in this whole situation is seen by many as changing enough minds so that people voted against the UAW.
It was strenuous opposition, both from Senator Corker and from Governor Haslam. Did what they do amount to a violation of the Wagner Act, of the law? Do you hear any talk of an investigation on that front?
Absolutely. The labor movement is up in arms over what happened in Tennessee. And it's very questionable whether you could actually interfere in an election like this. Now, it's not technical interference of being on the factory floor or, you know, harassing people when they were leaving the plant. There's nothing like that going on, but there are plenty of threats that possibly if the UAW is approved at Chattanooga, that the legislature might vote to repeal incentives to Volkswagen. That would certainly end up in court, and certainly the labor side of this could spark an investigation by the National Labor Relations Board. Certainly there would be complaints to the NLRB that this election was not handled fairly.
How big a blow is this to the UAW, and how big a blow is it to the larger union movement?
So I'm not sure it's a blow to the UAW in the sense that they've never succeeded to organize one of the new transplant factories in the South. So it kind of keeps their string of failures going. Conversely, it would have been a big victory if they had succeeded in organizing Chattanooga. So I'm looking at it as, you know, status quo isn't necessarily a blow because they've never been successful anywhere else. But had they succeeded, it would have been a major, major victory for them. So the broader labor movement is looking for every victory it can get. It's very hard these days to organize unions anywhere. A lot of the focus of the labor union movement has been on the service side. It's been at universities. It's been in retail and hotel, not in manufacturing. And it's extremely hard across the South to organize factories. Now that Indiana and Michigan are right-to-work states, it's probably going to be harder to organize up here, too. So the broader labor movement was hoping for a victory to sort of spur other efforts. Unfortunately, UAW didn't get it, and they didn't get it.
Does this result say anything about the leadership of UAW President Bob King?
Well, Bob King has been trying to organize a transplant factory for the better part of a decade, maybe more than that. This has been his focus. They've tried at Toyota. They've tried at Honda. They've tried at Nissan. They thought Chattanooga would work. They've been wanting to organize Mercedes. They always thought that when Daimler Chrysler was around that they could organize Mercedes. And so you have to question. I mean, I have a lot of admiration for Bob King. I like his style. I like the way he's led the people around him. But whatever he's doing is not the right strategy for facing down the forces that are opposing the UAW in the South.
We're talking with automotive journalist Mickey Maynard about the vote by Volkswagen workers in Tennessee not to unionize with the United Auto Workers. It's been reported that opponents may have tried to link bankrupt Detroit with the union in the minds of the workers. Any evidence of that?
Right. So what that is the workers, you know, you have to give a good case to the workers to organize. And one of the things that the UAW is saying is, you know, go with us and we will help you do better. We will help you get higher wages. We will help you get better benefits and more job security. Well, some of the workers who voted no said they looked at what happened in Detroit with the help that the UAW gave the car companies when they were in bankruptcy and afterwards, specifically the two-tier wage agreements that are in the UAW contract. Two-tier has been around a long time. It establishes a lower pay rate for incoming workers than veteran workers, but it was never a factor when the car companies were cutting jobs. The companies lately have been adding jobs, but they're adding them at significantly lower wage rates than they pay the veteran workers. The VW workers looked at this and said, wait a minute, your entry-level people make this much money, $14, $15 an hour. I'm already making more than that. You're not going to be able to guarantee me that I'll make $28 an hour because your guys making $28 an hour haven't gotten a raise for years. So the opponents to the union use that as an argument that, look, we're better off than the entry-level people at the UAW. How can we believe them when they promise us that wages will go up?
Labor leaders have suggested they want to organize more in the South because of job growth and population growth. Could this Tennessee setback force organizers to rethink that approach?
I think it might. This was the best shot that they've had in decades to organize a factory. And I have heard people say that this won't keep them from going on to Mercedes and trying to organize Mercedes. But here's the thing. Tennessee is a pretty, if you're looking at a conservative state, Tennessee is on the moderate side of conservative. Alabama's conservative. And there have been a lot of business leaders and government leaders and civic leaders who have spent the last 20, 30 years trying to get these factories in Alabama, essentially on the promise that they'll be non-union factories. So you can bet that there will be a fight just like the one we saw in Tennessee by officials down in Alabama if the UAW were to try to organize Mercedes.
There was talk that an approval of the union could have led to a German-style works council in Chattanooga. How does a works council operate?
Right. Under German law, representatives of the employees have to have a certain number of seats on the boards of the companies. And then the works council actually meets regularly with management. There's some joint decision making that goes on, and they are definitely privy to information about the company and have a voice in some decisions. So it's kind of like a joint governing body. If everybody remembers how NUMMI worked out at out in California between General Motors and Toyota and the UAW, there was something like a works council there. That was something like the way Saturn worked in Tennessee before that reverted to the master UAW agreement. So it's kind of a collaborative approach. Now, I'm not sure Tennessee law will allow that because the works council does act as a bargaining agent for the workers. And if the workers have turned down the UAW, I'm sure there will be court challenges to creating a works council because people will say they've turned down the UAW. There's no need for a works council. The workers have already spoken about this. They might try it, but I don't think they're going to be able to legally have any collective bargaining rights, and that's the most important thing for a union.
Mm. You could say Bob King has had several losses in his recent tenure, the Tennessee vote, and here in Michigan, right to work. He also made news after his failed attempt to woo Michigan State Senator Gretchen Whitmer to challenge fellow Democrat Mark Schauer for governor. Is there a win on the horizon for Bob King before he leaves?
Well, you could say the win is that the UAW participated in the bailouts at General Motors and Chrysler. I mean, General Motors and Chrysler are alive in part because the UAW stepped in and took part in the reorganization of those companies. They did give concessions. They didn't give wage cuts, but they made a bunch of changes in the contracts. And so you could give him credit for having three car companies. I mean, that's part of his legacy, I think. This broader issue of organizing a transplant car company is probably not going to happen on his watch. In Michigan, I mean, Michigan's been a little bit of a disaster lately for the labor movement. The UAW tried a couple of years ago to ban right to work. I'm simplifying this, but they essentially tried to push through a ballot initiative that would essentially ban right to work, and that didn't pass. And then right to work actually was enacted by the Michigan legislature. And these are pretty high-profile defeats for the union movement in Michigan. I don't think it's all his fault. I don't think it's really anyone's fault. I think it's political will and it's political attitude that's changed in the state. So rather than point fingers or say, will there be a win or have these all been losses, I think a lot of this is reflecting where people's minds are at across the state.
The UAW is a year away from new contract negotiations with the automakers. Now, during talks in 2011, the union did not seek higher wages, even though the car companies were starting to emerge from the economic downturn. Will the UAW push for higher wages next year?
So here's the dilemma that they face. If they push for higher wages at the Detroit car companies, when they go down to organize the transplants or try to convince the transplants to join the UAW, they're going to have to promise them that they can get something like that for them. And I think the workers in those plants are saying, I'm not sure you're able to do that. Look at what's up with your two-tier workers. So one of the things that's interesting is to look at the Canadian Auto Workers Agreement. Now they're called Unifor, but the CAW agreement has a two-tier system, but it bakes that wage back to the basic wage that veteran workers make. I think it takes 10 years, but the wages do go up over time and eventually return to that significantly higher level. That's not in the UAW contract. And so one of the things I would expect the UAW to try to do is get a promise from the car companies that eventually we're going to have one set of wages. We're not going to have some people making $16 an hour and some people making $28 an hour. The problem with that, of course, is that the car companies know that their transplant competition, their non-union competition, pays significantly less. And they will push hard to make sure that wages stay where they are, or at least if they go up very moderately.
Is it known, Mickey, what the impact is on worker morale when there are significant differences in pay between people working side by side?
Now, we did a story about this a couple of years ago for the Changing Gears Public Media Project, and we found people in the same family who are making significantly lower wages, the new person versus the person who's been there a couple of years. I'm not sure that it's an active morale issue simply because people are glad to have these jobs, and they're good jobs. They're still a much better job than working in, you know, say, a retail store or something like that. But over time, if your colleague has been there 15 years and they're making $10 or $12 an hour more than you, and you're starting to have been there for a few years and you're doing the same job, I can understand that there could be some resentment. But on the other hand, you hired in under that contract. You knew what you were hiring in at. You know, there's not much you can do about it.
Mickey Maynard, the editor of Curbing Cars. She's been an auto industry journalist for many years at media outlets, including the New York Times, currently a visiting professor at Arizona State University. We've been talking about last week's UAW vote in Chattanooga. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Folk singer Tom Chapin will be in East Lansing for a couple of performances this weekend. He's the featured artist at this week's 10-pound fiddle concert at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Grove Street in East Lansing. That's at 8 p.m. Friday. Chapin will perform at the City of East Lansing's Children's Concert Series on Saturday at 11 at the Hanna Community Center on Abbott Road as well. And current state Scott Pohl talked with Tom Chapin this week. Welcome, Scott.
Well, it's always good to be back. Thanks.
What's up with Tom Chapin these days?
Well, Tom's been in the music business for 5 decades, Mark. He started out with a family act that included his late brother, Harry Chapin. As you can tell with the show on Saturday that's specifically for children, he has a love for family-friendly music, and like lots of folk musicians, he has a big social conscience perspective. In his case, it's feeding the hungry, a cause that Harry Chapin had championed. Tom Chapin told me about his plans for the weekend shows, which include some Harry Chapin favorites. If you haven't heard him sing, you'll find out that he sounds quite a bit like Harry, by the way. And Tom's been here before. He says he likes playing in East Lansing.
Well, I do. The nice thing is that I haven't been there in a while, when you come, you find people who remember you and want to hear good music and want to sing and want to hear some of the old songs and some of the new stuff. And I'm going to have a chance not only to do the 10-pound fiddle on Friday night, which will be lovely, but on Saturday morning doing a family show, a kid show. So I kind of get a chance to stretch.
I want to talk about both of those performances, but I thought I'd get to something you just said, some of the old songs and some of the new songs. Why don't you tell me one or two of the favorite old songs that your longtime fans are looking forward to hearing? And then I also want to hear about maybe some of the newer stuff you're planning on playing when you're in town.
Well, you have to first realize that I'm a folk musician, which means planning is the last thing we do. I remember playing opening act for Conway Twitty once, and I talked to the band and said, "How long does he play?" And they said, 52 minutes. Unless he talks, then he does 53 minutes. And I'm a little different world, which is that I'll have a kind of a game plan, and then when I'm there, things move it and change it, and which is part of the delight of it.
And as the mood strikes you.
As the mood strikes me, and as the audience strikes me, and those things happen. So it's a little bit more like a jazz thing than it is like a classical thing, you know, where I'm going to play this thing for 17 minutes and this. But obviously some of the old songs are the songs both my adult and my family recordings. Pete Seeger just died, and so I'll probably do a song or two of his. And my late brother Harry's, probably do Cats in the Cradle and Circle, which are things that I always feel I should do, though.
And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man in the moon. When you're coming home, I don't know when. We'll get together then, son. We're gonna have a good time then.
And I have now 23 CDs, working on a 24th. So it'll be got a lot of material to draw from. And I'm looking forward to it.
So the family-friendly or kids show on Saturday will differ in what way? If you're going to sing some of those songs on Friday night, what will be different about Saturday?
Well, Saturday will be all the stuff from my 13 family recordings. And those I sort of know more particularly. It'll probably be a younger audience. So I'll do things like Big Rock Candy Mountain and This Pretty Planet and Family Tree and Together Tomorrow and some of the songs that are kind of... because I've been doing this for 25 years now, these recordings, there's a kind of a Tom Chapin family canon of songs. And also on my website, tomchapin.com, there's a place where people can actually request songs. And often people will send in and say, "Could you play Cousins, please?" You know.
They pulled into the driveway like a frigate dropping sail. And out came Butch and Mike and Bill and Ben and Baby Gail. Uncle Hugh looked hassled, but Aunt Bess was all aglow. Hello!
Hi!
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 Yo!
Cousins, cousins, here come the boys. Bedlam, mayhem, noise, noise, noise. Blow up the air mattresses, hide the breakable toys. Cousins, cousins, here come the boys.
There's so many songs now that no matter, you know, you play an hour and there's going to be some song that they wished you'd played and you don't know that until afterwards.
I wanted to ask you how widely known you think it is amongst your fans that you have this second part of you, so to speak, that does these family-friendly or children's recordings or programs like Saturday that are designed to include children. Does your fan base know about that typically?
I think so. I mean, it's what's really interesting is that it's really, you know, I remember Toshi Seeger, Pete Seeger's wife, once said to me, you know, if you don't watch out, you'll be just known as a children's performer. And of course, her husband Pete and Woody Guthrie and Tom Paxton and you go down the line. If you're a folk musician, you end up playing for everybody. But to answer your question, yes, I think people pretty much know that there's two strands to my to the river that I walk in. There's two. There's the, you know, the one side is singing for you and me, and for grown-ups and with ideas and stories and political stuff and the stuff that interests you and me. And then there's the other side, which is a family concert, which is also, if I do it right, it's interesting for you and your six-year-old, you know, or your six-year-old grandchild. If you and I were talking and there was a, you know, a 4 to 10-year-old in this conversation, we'd have a little bit different conversation. So what's different about it is the family show will have songs written by myself and my friends, John Forster and Michael Mark and John Cobert, that are specifically aimed at that age. And I've been totally thrilled with how people accept both sides and always have. And as I say, it's part of the territory that I grew up with. And once you have children, it changes your world.
You brought up your late brother Harry earlier, and I'm glad you did, because one thing I was going to ask you about is if you are ever interviewed and Harry's name doesn't come up, because he became so famous and died so prematurely, so tragically. I must tell you that in 1977, back in those days, I was writing a newspaper column with record reviews and concert reviews, and I had the pleasure and honor of interviewing Harry on the telephone before a Michigan appearance in Kalamazoo that year, and went to see the show in Kalamazoo. I consider that one of the high points of my interviewing career, that I got a chance to talk with Harry Chapin. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about your brother Harry, what he has meant to you, not just on a personal level or a family level, of course, but as a musician and as a songwriter.
Well, I mean, Harry was 2 years older than me, and we started as the Chapin brothers. The summer I was 12 and Harry was 14. And my younger brother, Steve, was 11. We heard a recording called The Weavers at Carnegie Hall. And the Weavers were Pete Seeger, Ronnie Gilbert, Lee Hayes, and Fred Hellerman, and that the seminal folk group in the 40s and 50s. And when we heard that recording, we listened to it all summer long, and it changed our world. End of the summer, Harry said, "We could do that." And he got a 5-string banjo, and I got a guitar, and Steve got a bass, and we became the Chapin Brothers. And for 10 years, we sang together. And so we were very close, and in musically as well as in the family way, you know, sense. And we grew up together, so it's really almost impossible to talk about how Harry influenced me, because we did it together, and the learning was so connected. But after his death, you start to realize what an amazing body of work the music is, and also, of course, the humanitarian side, the hunger work. And, you know, I mean, if you talk about Harry and my sense of Harry always was, we could do that. It's always we, very much like Pete Seeger, actually, never talking about me, but about we. You know, if we get together, we could do this. And Harry always felt, you know, we could end hunger in the world, which is a pretty large, pretty large dream. And it certainly hasn't happened in the 32 years since Harry's died. But those things he started, World Hunger Year, which now is called Why Hunger, and Long Island Cares, and an enormous number of people who were really affected by his commitment and his ideas, and who have taken over and kept those things alive. It's a pretty remarkable and legacy, and I'm totally proud and thrilled that people remember Harry so well. And the songs are great, you know. I mean, the body of work, if you look at Taxi and 30,000 Pounds of Bananas and Cats in the Cradle and Circle, and, I mean, you go down the line, it's a pretty strong, you know, musically. But then he has a whole other side to it, so it's really interesting. And I'm just thrilled to talk about Harry. The great, of course, sadness in is that he missed so much his daughter Jen, who is singing full-time now. Jen Chapin, and my daughters, Abigail and Lily, who are singing as the Chapin sisters, and he would have been thrilled about that. not to mention, of course, his grandchildren and all that. So in holidays, we miss him in a family way. But a remarkable guy, and I feel blessed that I was, that I grew up with him.
Who's playing with you, if anyone, when you come to East Lansing? Are you coming alone or bringing any side musicians?
I'd love to bring my band, but it's a small club and there's a lot of airfare going, so I'll be a solo. I'll be bringing my friends the six-string guitar, my banjo, and an auto harp, and singing songs of all shapes and sizes. And I've got to really love the club dates that I've been doing recently because it's really intimate, and it'll be fun to explore again. I feel really blessed to be able to do this kind of music and make a living at it. You know, it's hard to believe it's a job.
Well, Tom Chapin, I hope you enjoy your visit back to East Lansing. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Scott, and hope you come by Friday or Saturday.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we learn about the MSU Wind Symphony's trip to Carnegie Hall. That and more tomorrow on WKAR's Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the Current State producer. Thanks also to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michaeljohn for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us on Current State on WKAR.